Hello, and welcome to this, the final episode in this series of the True Tales of Luxury podcast. What can I tell you? I have had so much fun throughout this series. What a fabulous excuse to scour the store for its innumerable hidden treasures, meet up with friends, and talk about all the amazing and marvelous stories that lie behind them. Now, I'm excited to see if Stacey and Katie can rise to the occasion in this final episode by wowing me with their choices. I'm expecting to be even more impressed than usual, and that bar is already set pretty high. And to round off the series, I've got a really special guest today. It's Simone Rocha, the Irish fashion designer, who's going to drop by for a chat. With such a vivid design identity and a love for fashion that stretches way back into her youth, I can't wait to find out more about how she creates her incredible collections. But now it's time to join Stacey Duguid and Katie Service, our fashion and beauty editorial directors here at Harrods, to find out just whether they've saved the best till last. Good morning, girls.
Good morning. How are you?
Oh, very well this morning. Thank you very much. And you?
How much coffee have you had?
Number three.
Oh. How many shoots have you already done this morning?
Three. Yes. Yeah. This is basically lockdown living, isn't it? I have developed the most enormous coffee habit.
Yeah, I never used to drink as much coffee, but I have a whole pot of black coffee at 6 a.m. just to get through the downloading of this, you know, the homeschooling and you name it, the whole scheduling and summer plans and whatever and whatever. I mean, it's just, yeah, coffee, coffee, coffee.
Yeah.
Fueled by coffee.
I actually had a genetic test done a few years ago where they measure your genes against your nutrition and what you can and you can't eat. I had it done at Matt Roberts, actually. Anyway, they told me I was utterly immune to the effects of caffeine so that I could drink as much as I liked.
I would beg to differ by looking at the look in your eye.
Moving on, Duguid. I think you should start off. What have you brought?
Well, I brought something that I absolutely became completely and utterly obsessed with back in February when I was at the Loewe show. Now, let me get it out. Sorry.
In Paris?
In Paris.
Oh, those were the days.
Paris. Oh, Paris. How I miss you.
When we'll go there again. Who knows?
So, ladies, cast your eye on
big
this
cloth bag being opened here.
Beauty. I'm opening a cloth bag.
Oh, what
and
is that?
In it is a rolled up piece of canvas with the trimmed with the kind of Loewe tan leather.
Oh.
And I am opening up an Obi belt.
Oh, it's
designed,
gorgeous.
First designed, appeared in the collection rather, autumn 2017. Its architectural shape and sculptural shape emphasizes the waist and also the hip. Now, let me take you back to 2000. Katie, you were probably in kindergarten. Tiff, where were you?
Checking into the care home, darling.
Anyway, it was a trend to wear thick belts, and oh my gosh, did we go for it. Cinching your waist, you'd wear a thick belt over a T-shirt, but they were so clunky. And they were just thick and
Gucci
sort of
did
ugly.
Them, didn't they?
Gucci did them. Yeah. Everyone did them. Anyway, it was a thing. Now, I've avoided the thick belt with all my life. I tell you why, because I have a boy figure and I have no waist. It doesn't go in. So actually, if you wear a thick belt over the top, it doesn't do anything.
But just take you back to your Valentino belt from last season, though, which was such a hot seller that every time you wore it on IGTV, everybody wanted to buy it.
Okay, rewind. Never wear a thick belt over a T-shirt if you have no waist. Definitely wear a thick belt over a voluminous dress if you have no waist. There's a difference. And actually, I'll get onto this about the magic of this belt. At the show, I witnessed... Here, take it. Have a feel of it.
Can I try it on?
You can, because you have a teeny tiny waist. So...
I mean, an obi belt basically comes from the Japanese, doesn't it?
It comes from the Japanese. It's from the word obi comes from ancient Japanese, old Japanese.
Is there a stylist
from the words obu, which means to wear. And throughout the ages, the obi belt has had many iterations depending on the era. it started off as a thin little belt worn over a kimono style, and it ended up being quite thick. Do you know the history of the obi belt? Do you know anything about the obi belt?
I don't know anything about it, but it does look quite, almost quite kind of Japanese military.
So it's also got, now what are these called in historical costume?
It'll be, it's almost like a bustle or a corsetry. And that's what I mean by
kicking out.
No, it's not. There's another word for it.
Okay, come on, you study classics.
I know, I should know this. A pannier. It's a pannier.
A pannier?
Thank you very much.
Take a fashion star, Katie.
Oh my gosh, now I've got to guess some beauty fact. Anyway.
You'll have your chance.
That really suits you. And the way it's worn, and the way it was worn at the show by, I have to say, real women, front row, okay, they're front row women, so they're not your average woman. But still, we're talking about women of all ages, all shapes, from all over the world. And they wore this belt, and it really was a game-changing moment for me because I thought, actually, if you think about what you're purchasing now and what you're buying into now, if you're looking for one piece, this one piece dresses up everything, and it is a outfit game changer. You can wear it over a jacket, over a dress, you know, belted over a coat, even if you get it big enough, which is what I do with my Valentino belt.
Yeah, actually, can I just say, the Valentino belt was one of the best things I've ever seen you buy and wear, because you could wear it with a suit, you could wear it with a blouse, you could wear it over a skirt. It was really great. And what's amazing, that's the next iteration of it, isn't it? That obi belt. And it would, thinking about it, because Loewe is so much about that beautiful draped cotton smock, those beautiful white smock dresses from this summer. You know, a lot of it is actually not that tailored. And actually, if you put an obi belt over one of those,
especially something that's structured so purposefully over the hip, I think it accentuates your figure rather than trying to hide something. And that's what I love about this. It's sort of, it's really bold. It's a bold statement. But it's something you'll have in your wardrobe forever.
What would you say, Stacey, what would you say I would wear it with, for example?
I think you would wear that over, because it's plain. It comes in black. It comes in white lace this season as well. It comes in pure black leather, which
white
is...
White lace.
Can you hear the distant sound of a whip? I mean, it's so S&M, the black one. I could see you wearing that over a white prairie dress.
Mm. Beautiful.
God, I love the idea of the black one, actually, with the white broderie anglaise dress.
Super cool. But I just want to talk a bit about this brand and why I think it's a brand that you buy into and you keep forever, because it has so much soul. Its heart and soul and its DNA is embedded in the art of craft. And J.W. Anderson, who's the creative director of Loewe, Northern Irish. We have another Irish guest on the show today, don't we? I just give you a few facts about him. Fun facts. His dad, Willie Anderson, played rugby international for Ireland. And his mum was a secondary school teacher.
His dad was a rugby international,
I mean, it's incredible. And they had a house in Ibiza. So he was brought up in this Northern Irish landscape and this Ibiza kind of bohemia.
He
said that it really informs his design. What he does is he matches and marries romance with practicality, and there's something very feminine and very bold and strong about it. And I love that everything he does is embedded and comes from a place of the art of craft, handmade artisans. He has leather artisans who've been at the house of Loewe for 50 years. So taking these kind of dual inspirations, this Northern Irish landscape, these kind of Ibiza bohemia, you know, I really think that informs his design, this kind of romantic sort of pragmatism, really.
Yeah. Can I say as well that I think what he's done is he's really revived the brand. So Loewe stands for so much of that now. And actually what I love about the belt that you've brought along today is it's in the brand colours. So that beautiful linen beige and then the tan leather that goes with it. And there's no logo or branding on there, but you know instantly when you look at it that it's Loewe. And that's such a great hallmark of modernity and craftsmanship now.
And he was so young when he took the helm of Loewe in 2013. You know, he'd just graduated from the London College of Fashion in 2005. He actually went to study theatre and ended up in the costume department. He's a very interesting person who takes references from Velasquez paintings, you know, to his, you know, the Loewe Ibiza collection, which is so cool. He's a very interesting person, and I'm definitely getting that belt.
You should. Right, now, I want to bring us on to my little gift for you girls today, and I'm just going to shuffle over here and get it because you haven't seen it yet, have you? You haven't been peeking.
No.
I hope you haven't been peeking. Okay, this is three things of utter beauty about to land on the table.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
Please say those are edible.
They are. They look like jewels, don't they? But they are
amazing.
Actually
amazing. They've
edible.
Got actual gold on.
Yes, look, I've also got
Who
forks and plates.
Who made them?
Well, it's funny you should ask that, because that devastatingly handsome man you see over there in the white jacket
is,
of course, lovely Phil Khoury, our king of patisserie at Harrods. And I was actually going to murder these cakes, but trying to tell you how Phil made them, and I thought it would be much better if Phil actually came along and told us himself. He is our king of patisserie here at Harrods. You probably know him from your Instagram feeds during lockdown. He is Phil Khoury.
Hi, ladies. Lovely to be here.
Hi.
Oh, Phil, thanks so much for coming. First of all, I'm going to have to share these out because they are so beautiful.
Bring it to
now,
me.
Now, these are not just any old patisserie.
They don't look like any old patisserie.
No, I know. They're not any old patisserie. They're things of utter artistic beauty. But I went vegan at the beginning of this year, which, to be honest with you, was something of a trial.
How did it work out
Does
for you?
Does it feel a little bit wasted now? Well, during lockdown, I had a family to contend with who are not vegan, so unfortunately I had to put parts of it aside. But I discovered along the way that Phil makes vegan patisserie, and it is the most incredible process and method that he uses with the most delicious ends. So first of all, Katie, I'm going to ask you to slice your... It's basically like a yellow egg with gold leaf on it and coconut shavings on the top and coconut around the side.
It looks like lacquer.
Does this make you feel a bit stressed that we're about to cut into these creations? Because they're
just
so perfect.
Crack into it because it looks like it's...
Oh, it is literally a crack. Mm. That's a hard outer shell.
So, Phil, tell us what we're eating.
So... The thing we don't like to say that it's vegan. It's just a tropical dessert, and vegan is like in brackets at the end of the tag, because I think people bring a lot of preconceived notions about vegan food missing something. So it's just about the dessert being delicious. And
it is delicious.
Oh my goodness! But how do you achieve this without using dairy?
Well, I think it takes a really in-depth knowledge of how ingredients work to be able to find ways of just utilizing the functions of an ingredient, like as they are, without having to.
So this is coconut milk, is it, in here? Have you got
so
the creamy?
So for example, we've got a, to replace the cream component, turns out if you blend most liquids with a fat like coconut oil, which is solid at room temperature, with a really specific temperature and technique, you can achieve something that just whips like whipping cream. And so that gives it that really like lush, creamy texture. We've got much more fruit and much more of the good stuff that you want without the dairy masking the flavor. So it's just more fruity and more punchy.
And so hang on, do you think dairy does mask flavor? Do you think it's quite
overpowering? Yeah, so I mean, in a lot of cases, dairy gives a really beautiful like backing to most flavors, but sometimes it can overpower it or just mask some of the really subtle nuances, especially of like fruit flavors.
And so do you use other ingredients, non-dairy ingredients, other than coconut to achieve the same end?
Yeah, so like I'm using an oat milk in a hazelnut dessert that we're releasing for Christmas. In tastings, I don't even like to mention that they're vegan. We just present them. They get criticized, they get, critiqued, and then at the end it's like, oh, and they're gluten-free and vegan and
I've been to some of these critique tastings. They're quite funny, they're so amazing, the things that you produce, but you go through so many rigorous tests making things better and better and better, and all the chefs,
it's really an amazing process, because I think like in a lot of kitchens you just present something, people try, you try and then you serve it, but here we've got so many stakeholders, we've got buyers who get our product into the hall, and there's tasting processes. So we've got product developers that will brief us with a range of products. We present what we'd like to do. They give us feedback. We go back and refine, and then it's just this like constant
sort of process.
Sometimes you get it on the first go. Other times you need two or three goes. Sometimes it's just that little tweak, that little bit of gold leaf or something.
And what for you is the mark of a really good patisserie then? When do you know you've like achieved patisserie nirvana?
I think it's just when it tastes delicious, you know, and you could, for me, it's like when I could eat more and more of it.
That just happened, by the way. My plate is now empty. Did you discover this kind of methodology?
Yeah, so the crazy thing is that when, like, you know, as a team, we're looking at ways to expand our menu, to attract, you know, more customers and to be able to feed more people. And, you know, veganism is more than just a trend. It's like not going anywhere. And it's getting bigger and it's a stronger movement. And we didn't have anything in our range that for that customer. So it was about having to discover whole new methods and recipes and techniques because they don't exist. There's no textbook out there that'll let you go and replicate beautiful desserts that are plant-based.
And I think that's the thing about veganism is it often feels like deprivation if you don't know how to do it properly, yeah. Which is what I had to learn. And actually, you know, once I discovered this, Phil, you saved my vegan life.
Thanks.
Does it continue, your vegan life?
It's going to continue once I can persuade my family to let me pick up the baton again. But being locked down with three small children and a carnivorous husband, it was hard to remain vegan. But I felt so much better when I was eating vegan. And actually, interestingly, I ended up trying and experiencing more flavors and more ways of cooking because you have to be more inventive.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the biggest thing is that people struggle to know how to do it. So, I mean, I'm not a practicing fully fledged vegan, but I think it's really important that like we expand our horizons. Like, you know, a lot of classically trained pastry chefs have no idea how to construct a vegan dessert. You know, I was working in a 3-star restaurant in Sydney, and, you know, even at the top end, you'd struggle to get anything more than a really fancy fruit salad. So
really?
It's about just expanding our knowledge and making customers happy.
Fantastic. Phil, thank you so much for coming in to share this.
Really, thank you.
I'm now actually just going to eat the cake and stop talking.
Katie, what have you brought?
Okay, so I'm going to put it out there and say I've brought my favourite item in the whole of Harrods.
You have a very naughty expression on your face.
Because it's probably not
that sort of item.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Well, it's probably not what you think it's going to be. It's not the most luxurious. It's not the most... I'm just going to show you.
Oh, come on. It's a pink thing with spikes on.
Plastic, it looks like. It's in the shape of a butterfly, and it's got, like, pink studs coming out of it.
So this is an uka. So I've also brought my product from Japan today. An uka Kenzen brush. Okay.
Oh, it's a hairbrush.
Well, not quite. It's not for your hair, it's for your scalp. Which, I don't know, do you guys look after your scalp? Do you know much about your scalp?
I love having my scalp massaged when I have a massage. It just really relaxes me.
And the reason is, and I don't know if you've ever had this, but when I go to the hairdresser, I've often had someone go, touch my head when they wash it and go, oh, you feel very stressed. And that's because your scalp, yeah, it actually has a huge amount of kind of muscle that runs over it. So it can build a lot of tension.
Really?
And hold stress. And what you'll notice is next time you're feeling really, really stressed, you know, like the deadline for the magazine is looming, TIFF or Stacey or doing an Instagram live, actually touch the top of your head. And you'll notice it doesn't move much because it holds quite firm. Mm. But after you've wound down, maybe you've had your first glass of wine of the evening, touch your scalp again. It will be quite loose and movable.
I did know this.
It builds up tension, just like the muscles in your neck or in your back might do when you're feeling under the cosh a little bit. So this has a multi-purpose. This is a Japanese brush. It's actually based on, so a Kenzen is from Japanese flower arranging. And it's a little spiky sort of round thing that goes at the bottom of a flower arranging. And the woman who designed this thought it reminded her of that. So called it the Kenzen brush. And what it does is you get into the shower, you wet your hair, you apply a scalp cleansing oil. You need to get one of these, girls. Okay. They're amazing. And then you gently massage it.
Katie, all
vigorously.
I'm rubbing it
on my head.
All over her
hair. And it's because it's unbelievably addictive. You know those things that you like, which are like claws that you put over your scalp?
Yes.
And
yes.
They're called like, I don't know, maybe they're not called anything we should say on air. But this has the same kind of feeling.
Stress relieving.
It's stress relieving, but it also knocks off all the dead skin cells that's building up in your hair follicles. And it therefore allows your hair to grow healthier, get rid of kind of buildup of dead skin, which causes you to produce more sebum and get all clogged up and have greasier hair. And what I really find when I use it is that it feels like my hair afterwards has been washed by a salon. Right. You know that feeling when you go for a haircut and they just wash your hair in a way that you can't do at home?
Yeah.
This brush gives you that feeling. I find I need to wash my hair less once I've used this brush.
I'm actually just rubbing my palm with it and it's a really interesting sensation.
Tiff, please put it on your head.
Okay.
Because it's, you know, on, put, do it on the top first.
So you start the crown.
Yeah.
Because you know when you get those stress headaches.
I know.
It's incredible.
It's, but it's like, because it's sort of like the pikes, the spikes are made of silicone and they're sort of soft but hard.
Yeah.
So you can really be gentle but be quite effective on like the acupressure points on the top of your head. Honestly, it's a transformational
I didn't know
product.
About this scalp thing because I'm very aware of it. And I when I get a sort of tension headache,
yeah.
it's because my scalp was just literally turned to like almost like a piece of plastic. It's so solid.
Yeah.
Those 70s things you're talking about, you know, there's the wire thing.
Yeah, what are they? They're like called orgasmatrons or something.
Oh, that's they're in Austin Powers.
An orgasmatron from Austin Powers.
But it does make you feel
great.
Amazing.
Do you know what? I'm not saying much because I'm actually quite wrapped with attention on this because I have quite a flaky scalp actually.
Yeah.
And I've always tried to find, I like the Leonard Groix shampoo I use, which I find very effective. Yeah. So you suggest a scalp cleansing oil and one of these.
And what I'd really suggest actually is before you get in the shower and wash your hair on dry hair, get a hairbrush and just run it over your scalp. And what that does is it lifts off the dead skin cells first and the dry skin that you have there. Then get in the shower, wet your hair, apply your cleansing oil, and then give it a lovely massage in with your Uka brush, and then shampoo and condition your hair afterwards. Honestly, it will make such a huge difference. And I know that this isn't the most glamorous, the most luxurious little thing, but my goodness, is it one of my favorite products.
I love this. This is a life changer. Thank you, Katie. Now, over the course of this series, we've chatted to people from the whole spectrum of the luxury industry. And today, we're going to broaden our horizons a little more. My guest is celebrated Irish fashion designer Simone Rocha, and she's going to tell us about her new collection, which is due to launch here in Harrods very soon indeed. So, Simone Rocha, welcome to Harrods.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
It's nice, isn't it? And actually, Simone, you're joining us in the Perrier Jouet Bar, and you've just come through what has now become the new staff canteen.
Yeah, I was saying, what a nice canteen. And even the bathrooms at the end, like beautiful toilets. So, yeah.
Although I love those. Those are my favourite toilets.
Oh my God, they're amazing. I walked in, I was like, this is amazing. But yeah.
Very Victorian. Now, Simone, your collection lands at Harrods pretty much now, and it's the first time that we've had you here, so we're super excited.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to kind of introduce you a little bit to our audience.
Mm-hmm.
Now, people may well recognize your surname
mm-hmm.
because you grew up around fashion. Your father obviously was John Rocha. But I think you have come out with your own particular kind of identity in fashion that's very, very different and very, very particular to you. And I think the question I wanted to ask you is, how did you form that really individual identity when you grew from such a sort of fashion base?
Totally. And it's, I grew up, I'm very close to my parents, my mum and my dad, who both worked in fashion. And obviously my dad had an incredibly successful label, especially as a London designer. And I actually grew up in the studio. I was born in Dublin and his studio was in Dublin. I grew up very much around it and the kind of ethos of it, and it's where I started working and I loved it. But then I ended up not knowing what I wanted to do myself, except for the fact that I knew I wanted to do something creative. And when I went to art college, I realized that the way that I could kind of work my creativity was also in fashion. And it ended up that we have ended up with different identities, but I have a huge influence from him through his kind of silhouette, his love of textiles. But then what I've done is I've kind of translated that into my idea of femininity, which is very much where we differ. I think being a woman designing for women, you can have that heritage, but for me it was about making those feelings really important today and translating it into clothes today that kind of had that sculpture and that influence, but kind of in a more feminine-driven way.
And also very much 2020 femininity as well.
Exactly, which is, you know, for me, it's about it being strong, it's about it being thoughtful, it's about it being interesting, and it's about translating the thoughts and feelings that come through femininity in a way that feel really present.
Now, I'm going to take you back a little bit because you obviously trained at Central St. Martin's.
Yes.
And under the tutelage of the late, great Louise Wilson, who was an incredibly influential tutor there, what did she tell you about fashion design and femininity as well, I guess?
She was the most incredible lady and actually changed my life because I had done my BA in Ireland in the National College of Art and Design, and I went to do the Masters with Louise. And it was the first time I kind of met an educator that I had so much respect for because of her, not only her authority, but her authority, but also her kind of sensitivity to the students, which was masked by this, you know, very intense personality, which all came from a place of wanting people to do their best. And what I learned from her was she always wanted me to be able to forge my own identity. And I came to her loaded with a very kind of formed identity. And she was like, well, if that is you, you have to own it. And why is it? And you have to take in other influences. And how can that translate it and mold it? And it really, she really pushed me. And yeah, really kind of forced me to look at things in a different way, but staying true to yourself.
I mean, she has been responsible for the careers of so many of the leading lights of British fashion, hasn't she?
100%, like Christopher Kane, Craig Green, there's Roxanda, Jonathan Saunders, there's so many, like London fashion wouldn't be the same without her, actually.
And it's interesting, actually, because you're very much part of that group in terms of your kind of achievements and your fame. And I think that, how many British Fashion Awards have you won now? Three.
Yeah. Which I'm delighted about. I'm like, you're supposed to be like, oh, no, but I was delighted.
No, but from the get-go of you graduating, everybody knew this was a major talent that was here. But I wanted to ask how easy has it been to maintain that independence as a designer? Because there's so much commercial pressures on designers now, and you're still very much an independent label, mm-hmm. and you still very much true to your cultural and artistic roots. Do you feel the pressure to do something more commercial?
I've always thought it's such a privilege to be able to do what I do, be in control of my output, be independent, a family-run business. And for me, the way that we tackled doing things in a commercial way was actually working to open our own stores, to be able to share our message that it can, you know, this show is an absolute fantasy, you know, and it's this moment that's filled with adrenaline and emotion. But then it was really important to me that you could bring people into that community and they could break it down into pieces that they could wear every day. And that's why we have things like our accessories, our hair slides, our sandals, you know. And for me, that is the way that I've approached it, that has felt really right for me. And then, of course, I do take on commercial projects. Like, I'm part of the Moncler Genius Collective.
Yes.
And that has been a really interesting commercial project, which runs alongside Simone Rocha, which I have enjoyed as well.
Yes, and actually one of the things that is very interesting about your collections is, like you say, is the show is a big narrative storytelling moment, but actually if you break down the pieces in the show, there are some really easy ways into wearing Simone Rocha. And this collection, I was really taken with the blazers, actually.
Exactly, and for me it's always about things feeling interesting, but not alien. And still, when you wear them, you feel something, you feel present, but you don't feel uncomfortable. And that's always been really important to me and the women I dress, which is quite broad, and it can be something which is what something I reflect in my shows, different ages, different sizes, because I don't think femininity has an age or a size. And that's like you said, for example, in this coming collection, I did all these kind of tailored masculine jackets, but then I kind of ribboned through big satin ties. So then, you know, you can tie it up in a bow and feel like the femininity coming out from it, or you can wear it loose and languid and it's kind of almost like an oversized masculine jacket. And that's really important to me, that there's a practicality to the fantasy.
Mm. And as a woman designer, you know all about that.
Exactly, yeah.
So the collection, I think, was based on the Irish Renaissance play, Riders to the Sea.
Exactly, yeah, which was... actually a really tragic play about a family who lose the son, Michael, to the sea. And it's all about this relationship off the west coast of Ireland. And obviously I'm Irish and I'm really influenced by my heritage. And I just thought this very kind of turbulent relationship, it would be interesting to see how I could translate that into something today, and kind of felt the influences in knits, in embellishments, in textiles, and yeah.
I mean, one of the things that is the tropes of your collection is that it feels, as you say, it's a lot of it is about femininity, and a lot of it feels about those rites of passage around femininity. So there's an awful lot of things that reference bridal wear and christening wear and
exactly.
That kind of thing. And then it felt like, I mean, people were talking about there was a lot of references to death in this as well, because the fisherman loses their life at sea.
Exactly, and for me, it's always about a slightly procession and the idea of things being very ceremonial. And what I wanted with this collection, it ended in three ivory looks, which were kind of all done in beautiful lace that were then embroidered. Originally in the show, they were all in black, but it felt too mournful. And what I wanted was to translate them into ivory, so then the end became the beginning. And it was to kind of show that, you know, there's a continuous line through things always.
Oh, it was just exquisite. Stacey, you loved it as well,
didn't
you?
That's so romantic, yeah.
Yeah, and actually on the day, it was so stormy. It was like this big storm had blown in,
it
and it was kind
awful,
of...
It
was horrendous, and we were in Lancaster House and it felt like we were marooned and people would be
at
coming
sea.
Up, literally at sea. So, like, everyone was like, oh, no, the weather. And I was like, actually, it's perfect.
Your shows are amazing. The show venues are always incredible. I mean, the Crystal Palace venue was extraordinary. I'd never seen that space before.
Oh, yeah, this was my spring summer and we did it in this amazing abandoned Victorian theatre. And I just, yeah, it was amazing. I'd been showing in lots of historical buildings like Lancaster's House and Goldsmiths, and everyone had been in separate rooms. And I really felt like I wanted to bring everybody together. So that was kind of an amazing space to do that in. But yeah.
No, I can't let you go without asking you about pearls, because I think there's one person who's really owned pearls in fashion, Simone, it's you. And they are a sort of running theme through your collections. And I read somewhere, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you were inspired by standing behind Mary Robinson, that Irish minister.
Who is the most amazing lady. Yeah, I've always... It's kind of amazing. Pearls, for me, like, I have never been like a logo-type brand. And it's amazing that they almost feel like a logo. And for me, they originally started on this when I was back visiting Ireland, and I'd been in the West and I'd been by the sea, and I was looking at all the wet textures and I was thinking, you know, what be a jewel of the sea? So I thought of the oyster and the pearl. And on my way back in the airport, I was behind Mary Robinson in the security queue, and she was wearing a black turtleneck with these pearl necklace on the outside. And I just thought, wow, like, that's okay, this is so important. This has to be integrated into the narrative of this collection inspired by Ireland.
Yeah.
But she's an incredible lady.
Yes, she really is. Does she wear some of your clothes?
I don't think so. We did.
We need to change that.
I know. We did a piece. I did a piece recently. I put together a magazine called A Magazine and reached out to her, and we interviewed her for the piece. And Yeah, it was that was kind of a contact, but I don't feel she hasn't worn the clothes, no.
I love it when powerful women on the public stage really embrace fashion. I think it can be an incredible tool.
Totally, and in a way that I think can feel very, you know, natural, but in a really beautiful way. But like, yeah, for example, someone like Michelle Obama has worn our accessories, and like Kate Middleton and people like that who are like, really established in a completely different realm of fashion, but it can just be such a wonderful token to something and see that they are supporting female designers working in a way that they are.
Well, you are. Your brand really is the language of femininity and modernity today. Before you go, though, I need to ask you, you're coming to Harrods for the first time. Obviously,
yes.
You've had your Moncler work here before,
yes.
But for your collection, you're here for the first time. What are you most looking forward to bringing to Harrods?
Well, I'm really excited because I'm almost making a mini version of my own store. So in Main Street, I've got all these Perspex furniture, and it's kind of like a glass house to house the collection. And we're going to make a little version to bring it here, like its own little shop. So I'm really looking forward to bringing in like a little introduction into our world and place.
The world of Simone Rocha.
Yes.
Oh, thank you so much, Simone.
No.
It's been absolutely lovely talking to you.
Yeah, a real pleasure. No, and I'm really, really, really happy to be here, so...
I'm getting Thanks one of so those much. Blazers, by the way.
Yes, good. it'll be brilliant. I'm really looking forward to it. And it's a store I've always, always loved, actually. So, yeah, it's a real jewel. So I'm happy to be here.
Did you come as a child?
Well, I only moved to London to study. So by the time I arrived here, I was already 18. But I used to visit. I used to come and visit when I was... younger. My dad obviously always showed London Fashion Week, so we used to come and we'd stay in Claridge's and then we'd come up and visit, and felt very, very far away from Dublin. It was so nice. Delighted.
That just about wraps up this episode, and in fact, this series of the True Tales of Luxury podcast. Thank you, as ever, to Katie Service and Stacey Duguid for their excellent efforts in bringing some of the most amazing objects to my attention. I now have a very long shopping list indeed. And of course, thank you to all of our wonderful guests for joining us and sharing their incredible stories. It's such a treat to talk to some of the wonderful people who make Harrods the unique experience that it is. Thank you also to you for listening, and please don't hesitate to subscribe in your podcast app to receive new episodes in the future. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again soon.